It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For what is believed to be a first in U.S. history, UPMC has voluntarily decided to suspend its entire adult transplant program because of a suspected mold outbreak. The move comes in response to a situation in which four transplant patients contracted fungal infections, three of them later dying, though their deaths cannot be directly attributed to the fungal infections. It's also not known where the source of the mold is located. Federal investigators from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as the Pennsylvania Department of Health, are at UPMC Presbyterian and Montefiore Hospitals trying to figure out how to keep the possible mold outbreak from spreading. The investigation is expected to take up to 3 days. So how did this happen, and what are the investigators looking for? I'm joined now by phone from Baltimore by Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease physician and representative of the Infectious Disease Society of America. Dr. Amish Adalja, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a comment or a question, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Dr. Adalja, how does a type of mold commonly found in soil, leaves, and wood reach transplant patients in a hospital?
You have to remember that mold is everywhere in the environment. Our whole planet is full of microorganisms, including mold, and you can find mold everywhere, although you normally find it in places like moldy bread, fruit, vegetables, the soil. It gets on people's clothes. It gets picked up by the wind. It gets in the air. So you will find it in the room I'm in right now. I know there's mold in it. I know there's mold in the room you're in, because mold is something that is very, very hard to get rid of. It is ubiquitous in the environment, and it can, in certain instances, get into hospitals, and sometimes we've seen historically some very bad outbreaks that have occurred when mold is in a hospital setting and certain patient populations are exposed to it. But you have to remember, this is a very rare occurrence, and the fact is mold is everywhere, and I think that's something that's often lost in these discussions, how common mold is in the environment.
What type of mold was detected here?
So the mold is part of a group of fungi called the mucorales, or what we call, in shorthand, mucor. So these were mucor infections that were reported here, and we've seen mucor infections, over time. It's estimated probably about 500 cases a year in the United States of mucor. And what it is a very common mold that you find on bread, on fruit and vegetables and soil. It is really everywhere in the environment. And it often doesn't cause infection unless there's been some compromise of a patient's immune system, for example, a transplant patient, some diabetics with very uncontrolled sugars can get these infections. And we also oddly saw some cases that happened in Joplin, Missouri after a tornado when people were impaled with pieces of wood and debris in their legs and in their arms that had mucor on them. I'm taking care of injection drug users who have used contaminated needles that have had mucor. That's where you see these infections. This isn't something that the general public or staff members at a hospital who are not immunosuppressed need to worry about, because it really is an organism that it needs there to be some breach in the person's immune system, in their skin, in order to actually cause an infection.
And you mentioned the susceptibility of certain patients to something like this. Apparently the deaths of the three of these patients, we're being told, is not surprising because they were heart and liver transplant patients. I think two of them were heart transplant patients. One was a liver transplant patient. How might the mold from the hospital have contributed to this?
When you try to attribute mortality to an infection, it's a very difficult problem, because you have to remember, and as you said, that these patients that are reportedly have died and had this mold isolated from their tissues were very sick to begin with. These are intensive care unit patients who had received an organ transplantation. And that in itself is a certain situation that causes you to be predisposed to all sorts of infections, not just mold infections, but virus infections, bacterial infections. And this is a time that people are under, that it's kind of touch and go whether or not they get an infection after a transplant, because they've been so immunosuppressed in order to allow the transplant to take. And, in one way, transplantation is a humongous boon for the human population, because we're able to now live with live long lives, even if we've had organ failure of our liver or other organs. However, on the flip side of that is that now these patients are going to be susceptible to certain infections that wouldn't cause disease in a normal person. So what you find may have occurred is, you know, we do get a baseline level of mold infections in transplant patients. Those are to be expected. So you have to understand, you know, is this a blip? And I think the fact that you had three people in one room was a cause for concern, and that appropriately got the hospital working to try and uncover this problem and to take corrective actions and be very proactive and transparent with how they've dealt with this outbreak. But what you would assume may have happened, and we don't have any of the details at this time, maybe the spores from this mold may have gotten into a surgical wound, they may have been inhaled. That's usually how this these infections take hold, but it will be very hard to actually say that the mold infection was what killed somebody or didn't kill somebody, because you're talking about a very sick population to begin with, and attribution is a lot harder than it may seem.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease physician and a representative of the Infectious Disease Society of America. We're talking about the suspected mold outbreak at UPMC hospitals and the investigation into this very serious matter. Your comments and questions are welcome at 412-246-2002. We're going to go to the phones now. We have Rich from Garfield. Rich, welcome. You're on with Dr. Adalja.
Thank you. I gave my kidney, or donated a kidney a couple years ago over at Montefiore, and I was curious if the people that died were receiving the organ or donating the organ, because my understanding of the process is that the two people, the donee and the donor, are right next to each other during the operation. So that was my question. Were they receiving the organ, these people that died, or donating the organ?
What do you think, Dr. Adalja?
The patients that have contracted this mold infection have been recipients of organs, and it's not something that was transmitted as far as we know, in the operating room or anything like that. And it's important to remember that the donor of a kidney isn't the one that's immunosuppressed. Remember that the donor the kidney comes out of goes into a patient who then that person is the one who's immunosuppressed. And you have to remember that this mold really cannot cause much of a problem to a person with a normal immune system, an immune system that hasn't been suppressed by anti-rejection medication. So this isn't an issue of donors being at risk. This was really a limited population of immune-suppressed transplant recipients. And none of the patients were kidney transplant patients, which is one of the most common transplants that you actually do at any transplant center.
412-246-2002 is the number to call to join our conversation. Also, our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter, @esspgh. While there is no evidence that linens were involved in the fungal infections, they have reportedly been the culprit in mold cases at other hospitals. Should this make investigators suspicious, Dr. Adalja?
Like I said before, there's been historical outbreaks of mucor, this type of mold infections at hospitals, you know, over the years. And one of the more recent ones was at a children's hospital where we had a children's hospital, not in Pittsburgh, a children's hospital somewhere remote, that had cases that were tied to linens that had been contaminated. Now, there's no evidence, at least from what I've read in the press reports, that linens are implicated in this outbreak here. However, when you are trying to take stock of what's going on, it's important to remove all variables and create the best environment for patient safety. So it's completely understandable that you would see some modifications of how linens are handled, because linens can get contaminated. Because remember, mold is in the environment, mold is in the air. When people walk with linens, just like on your clothes, you'd find mold spores. If people have linens that are open while they're walking through a hospital corridor, there could be mold spores that land on them. And you want to remove that possibility, although it seems in this situation that this was done really to really do everything possible to get a handle on this outbreak, rather than any actual evidence that linen was implicated in this particular instance. But it has been something. We've even seen historically in other outbreaks with this type of mold, bandages being contaminated with it. Because the point I keep trying to make is that everything can get contaminated with mold because mold is really everywhere. So if you look on the bottom of your shoes, on your clothes, you will find mold.
Doctor, in your estimation, did UPMC do all it could to prevent this situation?
In my estimation, yes. I do believe every measure is being taken. From what you've seen in the press releases and in the news reports, this was an investigation that was triggered as soon as there was some pattern that was realized to be an aberrancy or an abnormality. You saw a whole intensive care unit being closed. You saw patients being moved. You saw a very proactive approach to voluntarily suspend transplantations, which has never been done before, in order to take stock of this. You've seen hiring of an international mold expert. You've seen the CDC and the Pennsylvania Department of Health be engaged at a very early stage. Also, the county health department, which really is out of their jurisdiction to deal with hospital issues, being involved, because this is not a these MuCor infections are not considered a reportable disease. You've seen the creation of a blog, which I've really never have seen before, which really speaks to a tremendous amount of transparency and proactiveness that's really characterized this outbreak from the start.
And what is the investigation encompassing? What are the federal investigators looking for? How will they evaluate what the hospital has done to mitigate risks to patients and to protect against outbreaks?
The CDC would likely look at the cases and try and understand how these infections occurred, when after the transplantation they occurred, what did the patients have in common other than the room. They would be looking at the other patient who had the liver transplant and seeing if there was any, what may have been shared in common. They may recommend tests to be done on the mold to try and understand how related these species are of the MuCor. They may look at the way environmental decontamination processes are done. They may look at the way we also give patients sometimes antifungal medications. They may be looking at all of those. They'd be looking at a whole host of variables and then recommend corrective action based upon what they see and try to prevent this from happening and get this transplant program back going, because it is, one of the nation's most prominent transplant programs, and we want to see it back online as quick as possible.
What would the corrective action be? I mean, if you're saying that mold, and certainly there's no reason not to be on board with what you're saying as far as mold being everywhere, that this is a very, very difficult thing for a hospital to prevent. So if there is a corrective action, what might that be?
It may have to do with, we've read about one ICU room having mold in the wall, and they had to take down that wall. So there may be changes in the way construction materials are done. Construction materials are used in an intensive care unit. Maybe different materials, maybe different processes, maybe different notification systems that may occur with the infection control division at the hospital, so that these types of, if these events start occurring again, that there is some trigger so that they can really be even more proactive than they were this time with uncovering it. There could be a whole host. It's hard to actually speculate without knowing the details of exact of the cases, but we've seen this happen in hospitals before, and hospitals do change some of their processes in order to minimize this risk. But again, these are transplant patients, and this hospital is known for transplanting some of the sickest patients in the world. So you're never going to be able to get this down to zero because of the fact that transplant patients do get mold infections and they are immunosuppressed. So this is something that you want to minimize as much as possible with your infrastructure and your processes and protocols. However, you have to expect that there's going to be some mold infections in transplant patients all over the world because of the nature of the procedure that they're undergoing. And that's kind of what the two-edged sword is of transplantation. You get an organ that you can live with now. However, you have to take immunosuppressing medications that put you at risk. And that's something that we're going to have to, that the risk of mold infections in transplant patients in any setting is something that we will live with until we get better at immunosuppressants and better at diagnosing and treating MuCor infections, which are really enigmatic sometimes and very hard to treat. It's really an unfortunate situation with that I don't believe there was any real preventive measure could have stopped.
No, it doesn't sound like many of the experts are echoing your sentiments on this. It's Essential Pittsburgh. We're talking with Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease physician and representative of the Infectious Disease Society of America. Still time for your questions and comments at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What a lot of listeners are likely wondering about, and I don't mean to belabor this point, but I'm sure a lot of people are having a hard time wondering how a mold outbreak happens at a hospital where presumably every possible precaution is taken to prevent contamination. And you've indicated mold is everywhere. This is not an easy thing to prevent, but I'm curious what the protocol would be. You may not be anticipating something like this, but certainly you're trying to prevent and take every precaution that you possibly can. So what is the checklist heretofore that a hospital like UPMC the UPMC hospitals like Montefiore and Presbyterian might be doing?
The first thing with preventing mold infections is construction. So when hospitals are constructed, when ICUs are made, they're built in such a manner that would minimize the risk of any type of mold getting into the hospital. However, you have to remember that there is water, there are pipes, there are people, there are articles of linens, things that come from outside into the hospital. So no matter how well you construct a hospital, there may be a chance that mold can somehow get into it. And the checklist will be to really make sure that when, for example, this ICU is reopened and maybe they make some modifications, that whatever they find to be the root cause of that mold growing in the wall is identified and corrective action is taken. And I think that will be what those recommendations would come from some of the experts that they've hired, outside experts that really are world renowned for developing hospital systems to minimize mold infections. And really, a lot of it is going to have to do with construction. You've seen them change the way they do fungal medications now to protect these. I think I read 11 transplant patients that had fresh transplants were receiving a new antifungal medication. That's something that they're doing, as a temporizing measure, but hopefully once they get more information from their outside experts, they'll be able to take corrective actions and go back to normal operations. But the checklist is really going to derive from construction and airflow issues, a lot of environmental engineering that's been shown to work in other hospital-based mold outbreaks.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guest, Dr. Amish Adalja. We will go first to Sam in Pittsburgh with a comment. Sam, welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, a question for your guest. As I understand it, there's a pretty well-known cleaning and disinfecting protocol used throughout a lot of hospitals, and I see they're called the Nissan approach or the Toyota approach. Have I got that right?
In general, what we see in the field of infection control, which deals with hospital cleaning as well as isolation of patients and those types of procedures, you do see an effort to try and incorporate some of the practices from, I think you said from Toyota, some of these best practices from industry. To streamline hospitals more efficient.
The UPMC does not use the Toyota approach. They use a variation of it. And from what I understood, and I understand this is just hearsay, that they don't have the cleaning staff and the staff to implement the Toyota approach. The second issue is that somebody really close to me worked in the ICU and in the MICU a year and a half ago. And I realize this is also hearsay too, but they were dealing with the mold along one big wall then, a year and a half ago, and they had the opportunity to take the wall down, and they just didn't do it.
Did they clean do you know if they cleaned the mold up, Sam?
Well, they cleaned the mold up, but they didn't take the wall down.
Yeah, I can't speak to any specific types of incidents like that. I do know that from what we've seen with this mold outbreak, that this wasn't a visible mold on the wall. This was within the wall, which makes it a little bit more you know, a little more tricky to actually realize that it is there, but there is a whole suite of infection control procedures that are in place at hospitals, including even, you know, very innovative ultraviolet radiation emitting robots that are being used to try and diminish the amount of mold in a hospital room. So there really is a whole host of things that are done at hospitals, but I can't speak to any specific wall that may or may not have had mold in it, or whether or not the identical Toyota protocol is being implemented at which hospital and which hospitals it's not being implemented at.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Adalja. If, as Sam said, and we'll use this as a hypothetical, but if, in fact, mold was found inside of a wall, would the proper thing be to take the wall down to remove the wall rather than just clean the mold?
Well, it seems in this situation, in the cardiothoracic intensive care unit, the mold was found within the wall. The entire wall was taken down. The intensive care unit was shuttered. The patients were moved to a different unit. So that's what happens when you find, you know, with this type of a mold infestation. However, you have to think about where the context of where the mold is, what types of patients are there, how easy is it to remove just that part of the mold, where does the mold go deeper. There's probably a lot of variables that are in place from an environmental engineering and a hospital engineering perspective on whether or not a wall needs to be taken down completely or whether or not this is something that's amenable to surface cleaning. And I think that really has to depend upon the things that are really outside my expertise, really in the environmental engineering field. Of how you make these determinations on what construction needs to be done or doesn't need to be done.
Let's go to Nancy in Whitehall with a question. Nancy, hi, you're on the air with Dr. Adalja. We seem to have possibly lost Nancy there. Let's go to Tony in Beaver Falls. Tony, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm sort of surprised that seems like a drastic measure. Obviously, UPMC thinks it's necessary, but is this something that was done in other places where they can't solve the problem? They just shut down the whole unit, or is it like a first-of-a-kind solution?
So Tony's asking if this unprecedented decision by UPMC to shut down its transplants temporarily is it a good idea, and is it something that is certainly it's unusual. There's no doubt about that. The question is it a good idea, I think? What do you think, Dr. Adalja?
From what I can tell, this was the right, they believe this is the right action to take because they need time to take stock of these infections, understand what may be putting patients at risk, and modify procedures. And you've already seen them starting to modify procedures in terms of the way they're handling linens, the way they've changed which antifungal medications they're giving to patients. And you really think that you know, this is really reflecting the fact that they're putting patient safety very high by not wanting to give anybody any kind of risk of getting these mold infections if they can in any way be prevented. And that's why they're taking this action, which is bold and I believe will probably bear out to show the so this was the right action to take because it allows them to have this time to get a handle on an evolving outbreak and restore confidence in the program and make sure that patient safety is kept the highest priority.
What happens to the UPMC patients who are on waiting lists for transplants?
Well, there are certain procedures that it's called UNOS is the organization that manages transplants for the federal government. And a shutdown of less than 15 days doesn't require any notification to the transplant list. However, transplant programs are very protective of their patients and are in constant contact with them. And I assume that if organs become available, that they will be trying to work to get these organs into these patients in some manner that they can do that follows the protocol and respects the suspension of the program. However, you know, this is a voluntary shutdown, and it's anticipated only to last 2 to 3 days. So hopefully there wouldn't be much disruption to these patients on the waiting list for organ transplantation. But it is something that's taken very seriously in general with organ transplants, and uh, and we everybody wants to see this transplant program back up as soon as possible.
Dr. Amish Adalja is an infectious disease physician and a representative of the Infectious Disease Society of America. Dr. Adalja, I think we've learned a lot today, and we appreciate your taking the many questions that have been thrown at you and helping us to try to make sense of a very serious situation at UPMC Hospitals, Presbyterian, and Montefiore in Pittsburgh. A lot of concern here, and I think you've certainly explained a lot. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, more Essential Pittsburgh, including a look at the fruit known as the pawpaw. That's later on Essential Pittsburgh. Stay tuned. It's 90.5 WESA.